You are listening to the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast, the official podcast of the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Here's your host, Tyus France.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for tuning into the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Tyus France. Sitting across from me is my good buddy, Alex. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tyus.
And today we're doing another one of our, we're just doing one of our podcasts, but we're not going to dive too deep into the news today, which is a little different from what we normally do, only because I lacked the research time to go out and grab great news stories. So instead, we're going to talk a little bit more about philosophy and specifically some ideals that go into our party. But before we do, in the background of, if you're watching this on YouTube, in the background of my screen over here, we've got the our website, lpnevada.org. And if you have not been there, please go check it out. It just got updated. You can find both of our beautiful faces on there, along with the faces of other team members. Alex, you put a lot of time and work into this, so thank you for making it awesome.
Oh, you're welcome. And I know our entire team worked hard to make sure that we could get those much-needed updates to our site.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So anyways, if you haven't been there, please go check it out. You can find our social events that are taking place throughout the week there. You can see how you can get involved, which is incredibly important. If you can get involved physically and donate some time, that's fantastic. If you can only get involved financially, that's a great thing too. We really appreciate it. You are helping fund freedom by going there and making an investment in our party. So let's talk a little bit about the party, because one of the things that is unique with the Libertarian Party over, I think any other political party that I can think of right now is we are often referred to as what the party of, what is it, ideals or?
Principles.
Principles, thank you. Yeah, the principled party, the party of principles. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of those principles and what they mean and where they have an effect in our current government, and maybe how they shouldn't be utilized or should be utilized within existing constructs. Man, I'm getting heavy. All right, so let's just dive right in. And I've mentioned this one before. This is pretty much the one of the big primary ones, and that is individualism. So individualism basically means that at the smallest part of what we look at people as individuals, not as groups. And that's a really, really important principle for us. It's a very, very important construct. The reason why that's so important is when you start looking at people as groups, you start inflicting generalizations upon everybody. And you run into all kinds of different problems where, for example, racism is definitely a collectivist mentality, while individualism is the opposite of that. So you can't really have racism when you're looking at people as individuals. You can't have sexism. You can't discriminate really based upon anything if you're just boiling it down to the individual as the individual. Now, there are some areas where this stuff gets challenging. So, for example, affirmative action is a big problem when you start going, well, we're grouping all these people into one particular group. Another example that I put on our little notes for the show is age of consent. It is a really, really hard problem. One of the problems that I think is almost impossible to tackle as a group. To say, well, somebody's okay to go and fight wars and potentially die when they're 18, but they can't drink until they're 21? I don't even know. I don't drink, so I don't know that. I don't even know these ages anymore.
You can't drink and you can't buy a handgun.
You can't buy a handgun? When can you rent 21. A car?
Well, that's up to the individual ones, but I think most of them wait till you're 21 to be able to rent a car. Although if you're like USAA or APSTAR or some of these like special programs or whatever, you can usually do 18.
Yeah. And I don't think there's any problem with an organization saying, hey, this is what we want to do, because then the free market gets into that and corrects that. And we're going to get into free market a little later. So anyways, that's a big, big tenet in our, one of our biggest principles as libertarians is that of being an individualist. Do you have anything on individualism before we move on to more stuff?
No, I don't. I think you pretty well covered that it's pretty central to our ideology as libertarians that people are individuals.
If you go to the national website and pull up their list, that is the first thing on the line. If you were to do a Google search, and I have, on principles of libertarians, that's the number one on the list, which surprised me. There's some other things that I think are very, very important. But across the board, it seems that that's one of the biggest fundamental tenets. So next up is natural rights. Now, natural rights can get a little bit confusing for people because it has that one word before it, natural. So I guess I'll try and explain that a little bit. The basics of it is the idea that you have certain rights that are inherently yours just for being who you are, for being a person. Now, where those come from are often debated. Some go, well, it's given to you by God, or it's given to you by nature, or it's inherited, whatever the case may be. That can be argued a lot. What is often not argued is what the basic three of those are. The big three is life. You're entitled to your own life. Liberty, which means your freedom. Freedom of movement, freedom of will, freedom of thought, and property. So because you own your own body, and your body can be used for labor, and you can spend your time building things or collecting things, those things become your property, and you have the right to have those. In the Declaration of Independence, they actually took those three and kind of modified it a little bit, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if you actually dig in and go to its origin, it's life, liberty, and property. And these, if you follow the root of this, it takes you down some really interesting rabbit holes. So, for example, tolerance is something that you have to have to have natural rights. You have to tolerate people that disagree with you because part of them having freedom is the freedom to be wrong and or the freedom to disagree with you. So there has to be a level of tolerance across everybody for these to exist. And in many places, that tolerance is not there. So there are places around the world where you're not allowed to have a different religious belief, or you're not allowed to wear certain things. Those all go away with these natural rights. Open borders is another great example of why libertarians believe in open borders. Now, that's not to say we don't believe in borders, but we want those borders to be open because the liberty part of that, the freedom of movement, is very, very important. And then you can see things where these are violated. So, for example, civil asset forfeiture is where the government currently can go in and take your property from you. So if you have natural rights of life, liberty, and property, somebody should not be able to come in and steal your property from you, regardless of whether that's a government or a thief or anybody else. It doesn't really matter unless you stole that property from somebody else, or unless there's somebody else that has a real valid claim on it. There's no reason. It's theft. Any other way of looking at it, it's theft. So this comes down to a current debate where is education or healthcare a right? Do you have some thoughts on this?
I mean, generally speaking, and I might even disagree with property being considered a natural right. And the reason is because it's not unlimited. And one of the reasons I think the founders changed to pursuit of happiness instead of property, which they had in earlier drafts and this sort of thing, I believe one of the reasons is because it's limited. There's a limited amount, and so it is, in fact, an arbitrary distinction. There are societies that have functioned in the past where there was no property rights. It was a collective ownership of everything, but you can't collectively own life and liberty, right? You can't collectively own education and healthcare. You can do that, in fact. And that's where I think the distinction is that education, healthcare, property, those are three things that I would say are artificially rights. And just because they can be given and taken away by a person, and there's a limited supply. So society has to decide who gets education, who gets healthcare, who gets property, however you decide that. And obviously there's a lot of different competing economic models and government models, but life and liberty, you can't, in pursuit of happiness, you might even argue, you can't give those in terms of there's a limited quantity. It's unlimited. You can have as many life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness as you want. So I might make the argument and distinction that that natural rights have to be, and I know this is philosophical, but this is my own personal belief, but I think that natural rights have to be an unlimited quantity that can't be limited really in any, you know, in terms of any kind of decision problem.
Gotcha. So I love that because it brings in economics to this, which sounds like the least sexy thing ever, but when it comes to ethics, it's really important.
Oh, yeah.
So basically your argument is if there's scarcity, scarcity creates value.
Yes, exactly.
And if there's value to it, then how can it be a natural right? Because if there is a limited supply of value out there.
And we mean economic value, of course.
Yes.
Right? Because obviously there's value to life and liberty, but those are intrinsic values. Those are things that are valuable to you, but maybe not to other people. Like your life is generally speaking not valuable on an economic standpoint to other people unless they're able to coerce you into doing something for them. But really what they're looking for is your work product, not your life.
Yeah. I think for me, when I refer to property in the life, liberty, and property thing, I'm thinking of the toils of your own labor, right? So okay. I look at it as the opposite of entropy. So everything moves toward disorder. So if you've taken dirt and refined it to harvest gold out of that dirt, that gold that you refined belongs to you, provided the dirt was yours to begin with, right? You get to have the spoils of your riches, and then you can trade those with other people. But I think there is a really important distinction that you bring up, and that is to say that property is a natural right, generally, to say that you should have whatever property you want is completely wrong. Like that's a
disaster. That's why I wanted to make the distinction there for our listeners, so we don't get too many angry letters in the mail. I think that again, when you're talking about natural rights, and I think I don't know which philosophers agree with me and which don't, but I mean, I think you really have to look at their scarcity, and because again, how can it be a natural right if it's scarce? You don't have the right to intrinsically to gold. You might have the right to pursue gold and acquire gold, which I would argue is liberty and pursuit of happiness, but you don't have the right to intrinsically possess gold or any kind of scarce anything.
Well, but to say then that, let's say I've on my property, I find some gold, it's my property currently. To say that I don't have the right to that property would imply that somebody could come in and take that property from me.
And can't they?
They can, but that violates that natural right. In the same way that they can take my life from me.
I would argue that although large, it's not infinity, the amount of property and wealth that we have in this world. And because it's large but finite, it seems as though, right? In other words, there may someday come a day where we're not entitled to as much land as we can buy.
Sure.
Simply because, you know, if we hit, I don't know how many would take, trillion people, right? We're Coruscant.
We're close.
Right? And we have, I mean, you drive out through Nevada and you know that there's plenty of land in this country and many others. And so, you know, that's not a concern today. It's a large, there's lots of land. There's lots of resources. We're 3/4 water. You know, all the basic things you need to live. There's plenty in quantity, and it's large. But I would caution that, you know, and you might make the counter argument to me that, well, someone could take your life or liberty too, and that's true. But those are things which, you know, to you, again, very extremely valuable. To other people, less so, if not zero. I mean, you might value someone on a personal level, but you know, I'm totally getting twisted up here. I think what I really want to say is just that natural rights have to be an unlimited kind of almost idealistic concept.
Yeah.
Because in the real world, so to speak, you don't have the right intrinsically to property. If we said that, then I would worry that some might use that as I have a right to your property.
And that's where I think it comes into being very important, where it's the spoils of your labor. Right, like it's the labor that you produce. You have the right to your labor because you're the one who worked that labor. Because if you don't have that, then you're back into slavery, right? So
sure.
If somebody else has the rights to my labor, then we're in a slavery situation. So the rights, what I produce, I should be able to sell. Now to say that I have the right to all property is a huge problem because that violates everybody else's property rights.
Exactly, and I think that that's something that I wanted, I really want us to emphasize simply because a lot of, I would say that a lot of people on the left, the economic left, really think that the property is a collective thing, that society owns the wealth and property of a country's borders, and it's society's problem to decide who gets what. And I think that we would both argue that it's the individual's right to work hard and purchase from others their own parcel of land on which to have their own castle, so to speak.
Sure. So Bernie Sanders is
yeah.
Is,
I didn't necessarily want to bring him up, but for sure.
Oh, it's done. It happened.
Yeah, he's
the so worst. He's saying you know, education is a right. He's saying healthcare is a right, and based off of what we were just talking about, that can't be true, right? Because there mm-hmm. there is a scarce quantity of teachers in the world. There is a scarce quantity of hospitals and doctors in the world. So what ends up happening when you go down this road of natural rights is if you say education's a right, ultimately, if it is, you are eventually going to have to compel people to be educators. You are going to have to force them to be educators. If they are a healthcare provider and we don't have enough syringes, but you've decided that healthcare is a right, at some point, you're going to have to force somebody to labor to make more syringes, or force a doctor to work, to be out there. It violates that scarcity principle, and ultimately, if you're talking about property as the spoils of somebody else's labor, you are violating their property rights. You're violating their liberty rights by forcing them to work, and so education and healthcare cannot be natural rights. It just can't be. Mm-hmm. They're as unnatural as possible because they have to be inflicted. There's no other way to get around them, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. I would argue that those are artificial rights that you get because we live in a society that believes in education and healthcare, but they're not natural rights, certainly. And you might even make the argument and go so far as to say that they're not rights at all. They're privileges extended to you by our society. So maybe yep. artificial rights and privileges are equal to each other in terms of, you know, the grammar.
Maybe a different word for it would be entitlements.
Maybe. I don't know if entitlement is just such a bad word now, don't you think?
Yes. You know? And that's exactly how I want to frame it.
let's go with privilege, right? All right. Because everyone understands the whole, you know, your mom's mad at you and, you know, well, this is a privilege.
Sure.
Right. I think we all kind of at a fundamental level understand that.
Sure.
And that's what education and healthcare is it's a privilege extended to you from the wealth and contributions made by others in your society.
And it comes from that scarcity argument. It wouldn't be an issue. There is a certain amount of atmosphere above our heads. There's so much air in this world, right? But there's enough where there's not an issue of scarcity for us. And because of it, we don't have to look at that and say, well, air is not a natural right because there's a limited supply. There is a limited supply. However, it grossly exceeds what we need. And if there were so many people that really wanted to be teachers so much, as we get, when we get into free market stuff here, they'd basically be paid nothing. If all we had were everybody was a teacher, so they all become kind of worthless because there's so much of them, then education may be a right because there's just too much of it. There's excess. But that's really not where we're at right now. Education is one of the most expensive things that we pay for mm-hmm. as a society.
But what's really interesting to me, Tyus, and I think that we should maybe take a little bit of a side road here, is that with education, because people in our society feel that it is so important to have a well-educated society, that they are pouring their money into nonprofits that are providing free online education for students, and it's reaching them at their level. Podcasts, for example, videos.
Khan Academy,
yes. And I think that, you know, in the past, I think our ancestors also believed, even our libertarian ones, that education was so important to a free society that we have to have the government pay for it. Because they couldn't imagine a business, let's say, or a nonprofit so large, a charity so large, that wasn't the church. That's an important distinction. because they, of course, saw the issues with that in the 16, 1700s when you've got people like Galileo getting, you know, strung up and this sort of thing. So they knew that it needed to be a secular institution separate from the church, but it needed to be an organization large enough, and it needed to come from basically the wealth and generosity of Americans. And in the beginning of our country, education had to have been provided by the government, sure.
Well, it's a great example of how the government grows, right? It was handled at a town level. You know, you have the little tiny schoolhouse.
Right. And then when I mean the government, I don't necessarily mean the national one. But yeah.
Because that's only the 1970s.
Exactly.
Right?
Originally, it was the little schoolhouse, and it was your
then it became state, and then it became federal. And as it's grown, unfortunately, if you look at the graph, our education's declined.
Yes, relative to other people, our education has definitely declined. And so what's really cool about this, though, I think, and I want to definitely mention this again, is that places like Khan Academy are a free market solution to an education problem that our society faces. And they are doing it so efficiently that they're able to provide it at a much, much cheaper cost, free, in fact, without having to coerce anybody to pay tax monies for it. And I honestly think that in 20 years, you know, right around the time my kids are maybe in you know, middle school, that we may see an entirely online education experience. I think that the brick and mortar school will go away.
Hmm.
And people are upset about that. They think, oh, they won't get the socialization they need. They won't get, and there's some truth to that, except when you consider that there are a lot better ways for kids to become socially normalized. Sports, band, you know, these are things that you can put together that don't require a school to put together. Right, you got meetup groups nowadays. You got all kinds of ways of finding buddy. You got those buddy programs, those apps that let you find people that like, you know, singing and playing bass. And
we should do a whole episode about like our utopian ideal future.
Yeah,
of like this is how it would work if it went our way.
And I think that the transhumanists in a lot of ways are kind of on the right path of where technology is providing us an ability to do it so cheaply. And so, and not bad quality, mind you, just inexpensively, and at a large scale that we've never seen before. And the internet has really revolutionized how we do everything. And we've got drone deliveries of food to your door now. I mean, fast food has gone from drive-through to drone delivery to Uber delivery to, you know, and I know Gary Johnson on the campaign trail last year really, really mentioned he wants Uber everything. I think that's an important concept that a lot of things, I think a lot of things in the United States and especially other countries as they continue to grow are going to become similarly revolutionized. There's entire industries.
I just used an app called Doctors on Demand. Have you ever heard about this?
No, tell me about
it. So Doctors on Demand, by the way, we are so not, this is going to be the longest episode ever. so Doctors on Demand is an app for your phone, and there's apparently a couple of these where you go on and they'll take your insurance if you have it, but if you don't have it, they'll charge you like $40, a flat rate, right? Mm-hmm. And it does a video chat. And you can look at the reviews of everybody on there, all the doctors. So in the same way that you go to like Amazon.com and you see what the best product is and what the worst product is. And maybe you're like, I'm willing to wait for the very best. Or you can say, I want the first available. I don't even care. Mm-hmm. Right? This is about urgency to me. And you give them, I think, whatever it was, your $40 or whatever for your visit. And they get on a video chat with you, talk to you about your symptoms, go over your options. They can call up your pharmacy and write you a prescription right through your phone.
What?
So you don't have to go to the doctor's office anymore.
Wow.
And I was looking at, I was like, this is, you know, how do you Uber doctors? That's how you do it. That's how you do it. You bring the doctors to you using beautiful technology, the same kind of tech we're using in these podcasts. That's what they're using to deliver medical care. Now, you obviously can't do that when they need to put you in an MRI machine, but for so many things, they can absolutely look at on a camera and be like, oh, that's what this is. They know exactly what it is, and it takes them a second to figure it out. All right, let's keep moving on because you guys are in for a long trip with us today. Here we go. I'll go faster. We'll get through this. Next principle is that of spontaneous order. So what that means, what they're talking about when people talk about spontaneous order is a freedom of association rather than coerced association. So if people want to hang out with each other, they should have the right to do it. They shouldn't have to associate with people that they don't want to associate with. This goes back to the gay cakes thing that we've talked about on a few episodes.
And even the Supreme Court has acknowledged that honestly, you can't compel someone to bake a cake for you.
It's crazy. Going to the natural rights again. You can't compel somebody to do it. There's a great book we've mentioned called iPencil, which shows how people are interdependent on each other. The basic premise of it is how hard it is to make a pencil requires thousands and thousands and thousands of people all working together to make one little thing that you can get for about a nickel.
Yeah.
Or people will just give you for free.
Because there's a great video on it, too.
Is there?
Yeah. If you go to YouTube and Google, or Google. Google on YouTube. Well, it's all owned by the same
company.
If you type in iPencil, I actually watched the video version of this booklet, and I loved it.
Yeah, it's great. And it shows how we come together as a society spontaneously for the needs that we have. And strangely enough, that doesn't make it more expensive. That makes it less expensive and more efficient. Okay, let's keep moving on. Our next principle is that of personal accountability. So, libertarians, we abide by the law. And on top of that, we honor our commitments. Now, I know that seems like something that everybody would just say, we do that. However, there are several organizations, several beliefs out there that certain people, certain groups, certain demographics, whatever, are not accountable to the commitments they've put out there. I guess bankruptcy is maybe a decent example of that, right? If somebody goes out there and says, you know what, I can't pay all my debts, I'm off the hook. The government goes, yeah, you're off the hook, and you're done. There are dark sides to personal accountability, right? If you can't provide value, if you can't improve yourself, then suddenly you don't get the welfare. You're accountable to your own actions. You don't get a free handout because you're incompetent. You have to go out there and make yourself relevant and make yourself valuable. Now, that's not to say that charities can't go out there and do it or private organizations can't go out there and do it, but there's no guarantee that there's going to be a safety net underneath you because your accountability is your own and nobody else's. Keep going.
I guess I'll mention that there are some people in the libertarian movement that don't believe that they should have to abide by laws that are immoral or unjust. But I would argue that it's more important for us to work together to change these laws than it is to demonstrate how terrible they are. Like I saw a recent example where there was a jaywalking, you know, where they had a little get together to go jaywalking. Now, jaywalking is not it's almost a silly crime for a police to enforce, but sometimes it makes sense, right? If you've got cars on the road and you don't want people to get hit, you know, and you don't want people just wandering outside of crosswalks, then there's at least some idea here. There's some logic behind why you would...
It's preventative crime, right? Like, No, there is no victim. However, we put a law in effect to prevent potential crime. The same law
prevent victims.
Prevent victims.
Yeah.
Same thing as speeding.
DUI.
DUIs is the same thing. Pretty much every drug law that's out there unless it's violent.
Yeah. And I might argue that you know, that you could, if there could be a victim, because the government could always find a way to find a victim. But I mean, if there was a certain probability that was maybe large or increased based on your behavior, I can understand them wanting to deter that. I can understand that. I mean, again, just speaking as me. And so we have to work together to create laws that, you know, in addition to preventing this, you know, kind of future crime, if you will. I know, and again, I know that sounds ridiculous, but we do it all the time in society. I mean, all the time, we talk about preventing crime because that's better, right? Because again, everyone acknowledges that if you hit someone with your car while you're drunk, that's a crime.
Absolutely.
No one disputes that. There's a victim. There's a clear victim that has lost life or liberty or some
their car
piece in between. Lost their car, yeah, exactly. Property.
Property.
Exactly. And so laws that prevent, you know, crimes with victims, I can understand where there's a clear probability, there's a clear connection that I think you could scientifically measure the connection between the two. Where I start to see it get fuzzy is maybe drug laws. because there's so much misinformation out there about like marijuana. I know everyone that is in my generation went through the DARE program. I don't know if that was also something that was going on.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, all the misinformation about marijuana, which has killed zero people. Nobody's ever gotten high and killed someone, to my knowledge. And nobody has ever gotten high and died.
But a lot of people have died due to the war on drugs.
Yes.
A lot of people have died due to that.
A lot of people have died because of the stupid laws about enforcement of drugs. And I would even make the argument that the criminalization is not going to prevent the drug use. Rehabilitation will. And now, again, when it comes to something like jaywalking or DUI, you can rehabilitate someone from their ability to make decisions about whether they're drinking or not. And that's probably better than prison, to be perfectly honest. If you're using marijuana in your own home and it doesn't hurt you, there's no preventative crime there. That's a 100% free and clear victimless crime that should not be on the books and should not be enforced.
But all of those things, basically, if you go back in time and look at bad laws, even recent bad laws, they use the argument of we are preventing some kind of damage. So, for example, marriage equality, right? The idea that, well, gay people shouldn't be able to get married because it's going to destroy the civil future union, whatever. This insane idea that you're going to destroy something in the future. It's the idea of this means to an end. If you're looking for a bad argument for a law, it's always going to be based off of the idea that, well, we have to do preventative warfare. Is that a new thing now? That's a thing, right?
Preventative warfare.
They go out and they go fight a battle. They go kill people.
Oh, preemptive strikes. And stuff. Yeah.
They're going exactly. to war. It's the mean. They're like, well, you know, the means justifies the ends. Well, there is no end. There's no end in sight. So don't even start.
Exactly. And something like marriage equality, I would argue, again, there's no violation of someone else's life, liberty, or property. And of any kind, and society can't be, you can't victimize society. I think that whenever the victim's not a person, you have to be able to identify a person who's the victim.
You have to identify a victim at all, right? So like jaywalking, there is no victim unless somebody slams into him.
Right.
And now it gets weird when you start saying drunk driving, where you can definitely show, you can definitely show correlation, right? But until an actual victim takes place, it's really hard to narrow that down.
True. And I think that there's plenty of statistics. I know Nevada has been really big on this year about trying to lower the incidences of jaywalking because they've shown that that's one of the number one ways that they get hit.
Well, especially on the Strip.
Yeah, the Strip, but Boulder Highway is one of the number one ones.
That makes sense.
And these people, a lot of them are getting hit in crosswalks as well. So that's clearly there's a victim, and that wasn't the person who was using the crosswalk. But when you wander in black clothing across a street at night, in a non-well-lit area, across of a highway, and that's what we're getting. I think that's what we're getting at by abide by laws, don't you think?
No, if you are the person putting yourself in harm's way by crossing the street when nobody can see you and not looking both ways, yeah, you're kind of accountable to the fact that you might be putting yourself in front of a car.
Exactly, and I would never want to see a law where we would hold the driver accountable for someone else's idiocy.
Didn't that happen with Black Lives Matter? They were blocking freeways, and then occasionally a person would like push through, and then they'd be like, well, you hit me with a car. And then it's like, you literally put yourself in the middle of a freeway. Now, I know that's kind of a hot issue.
Yeah, I could see it being very circumstantial there in my mind.
But they're ultimately, in that sense, the Black Lives, if somebody is blocking somebody else's ability to move, you are preventing liberty. You are violating somebody else's natural rights. Okay, let's keep moving on.
Yes.
Because we can go way down that one.
All of these tenants deserve their own episode, I think.
You're probably right. Okay, next one. This is going to be the easy one. This is the one that, if you were to describe the party, it probably how you'd define it, and that is that of limited government. So, the Bill of Rights is something that I hold very dear, and you might say, well, didn't you already talk about natural rights? Well, the Bill of Rights is really not about your personal rights. The Bill of Rights is really about what we should do to limit the government's power. Every single one of those things, let's say the First Amendment, right? First Amendment is free speech, really, but it's talking about not letting the government limit your speech.
And I think that they are specifically enumerating liberty Right. So they're derived natural rights, if I might go so far into my engineering speak. Right. You're deriving natural rights from liberty, and the First Amendment is a list of those liberty natural rights that you have. And I'll remind you that all of those rights, and I've never heard a counter argument to this, are unlimited.
Yes.
You have an unlimited right to free speech.
The only one in there that's not is a defense, right? You get a public defender, which...
That's in the bill?
I think so. I could be wrong, but I think that's...
I'm going to get this one. I don't know.
Fifth or sixth, somewhere in there.
But in any event, like even the right to bear arms might go, but arms, there's a limited quantity. We have the right to bear them, not the right to possess them or own them. The government doesn't issue everyone a free gun, right? That's not what it says. It says you have the right to bear them, to use them for self-defense purposes.
That goes back to the property thing.
And that's unlimited.
It's not right? saying
you have
it's
an unlimited right to bear arms.
It doesn't mean you have an unlimited right to have as many guns as you'll ever want. It's that if you own a gun, you have the right to own it. Yes. Somebody cannot take your right away from ownership.
Well, and the government in particular.
Specifically the government. Yes.
Although they've done it all the time. I mean, for every single bill, there's been numerous examples of the government just trampling.
Yeah. So with the limited government as a big principle, a big tenet of our philosophy, there are different camps within this, which we've talked about before. Anarchy versus minarchy. And here's the thing that is united across those. They're both going toward a limited government. It's just a matter of how far they go. And in that journey, we can unite together in moving toward that. In the same way that people wanting positive civil rights might have gotten in that Million Man March with Martin Luther King, right? Where it doesn't necessarily align with maybe they're white, so they might not... It might not be just about color. It might be about equality across the board, something like that. But they can get on board with the same ideas because they're going in the same direction. And whether you're an anarchist, a minarchist, if you're a libertarian, you're moving in that same direction. So limited government is a big principle of ours. Okay, next one is free market. So the free market, the idea of a free market, which is almost doesn't exist anymore. It makes me sad to think that it doesn't exist, but... The idea of a free market is that supply and demand regulate price, and that's it. So when we were talking about scarcity of rights, things that are scarce, that's what creates a price. If there's a limited quantity of screwdrivers out there, then and they get really limited and the demand is really high, then suddenly screwdrivers become really expensive. Now, that's a free market, and that free market is really, really powerful. Which we can probably dive into. Geez, that could be two episodes.
I love talk about the free market, Tyus.
Yes. So, on the other hand, if a government steps in and says, everybody deserves a screwdriver, and we're going to make sure that that screwdriver remains at a certain price. Now, obviously, they're not doing that with screwdrivers, but they are doing that with things like corn, for example. Corn is a subsidized product. So, if they say, or beef is another example. I don't know why I'm going into food. I'm hungry. If they subsidize that, they suddenly change the market from being a free market to not a free market. Other examples of this would be interest rates. So interest rates are there as a natural... basically, it's saying, here's the cost of money. If you want to borrow money, here's the cost of it. Now, if everybody has a lot of money in savings, if the bank has a ton of money in savings, then the interest rates are going to be low. It doesn't cost them very much to lend out money because so many people have money stockpiled away. If very few people have any money, interest rates should be very, very high. It should be very expensive to borrow money because there's not a lot of money saved around the country. However, we don't have that free market. Interest rates are being controlled. And because of that, it messes up everything. It messes up the economy. If they are artificially being held low and because of certain... fiscal policies, they believe that spending is the answer to everything. Suddenly you end up with a country that doesn't have any money. In fact, that you end up with a country in tremendous debt, which, hey, that's us. So those are the ideas behind a free market. A lot of these could be resolved with a few basic things. One of the big ones is the Federal Reserve Bank, which is not federal, not has no reserves. It's not a bank. So we should probably at some point talk about what the Federal Reserve Bank is. But since I'm at 40 minutes already, I'm going to keep moving on to the next one. Free market we could go deep into. But we believe that the free market, in short, is one of the most practical ways of creating fairness and equality across the board. It's one of the best ways of identifying value, and it is one of the greatest ways of punishing somebody without needing a law enforcement agency in there. If somebody tries to violate a free market by creating a good or service that is not valuable to society, they are punished because they get no income from it. Okay, let's move on. So the next one is production over consumption. And I mentioned this a little bit in the free market area. There's several types of economic models, but two big ones is Keynesian, which a lot of people will say, oh, that's Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics is basically the idea that consumption moves an economy forward, and with that, it requires adjustments made by somebody who's overseeing it. That's really how our government works right now, is that they're trying to push consumption. Everybody go out and buy things, buy stuff, which is fine. I have no problem if you want to buy stuff. That's cool. And then the second part of it is that you should go in and occasionally the market's going to get out of whack, so you got to adjust it. You got to fiddle with it a little bit to try and put it back into equilibrium. Austrian economics is kind of the exact opposite. It does not say that you should touch it at all. In fact, it says that it works by itself, but it's not about consumption. It's about production. It's about how much you create that makes value. Because if you don't create something, you can't consume it, right? So you can't go out there and buy things if it's never made. So they're two very, very different models. As far as libertarians are concerned, production is much more important than consumption. Not to say that consumption's wrong at all. It's simply that you don't try and stimulate an economy by getting people to buy more cars. You try and stimulate an economy by getting people to build more cars or any other product for that matter. And last and not least, last principle on here, which for me, this is the most important one, is peace and tolerance. So we are a party of, we don't tolerate war. That's not to say that we don't believe in it. That doesn't mean that we're all pacifists. There are times, if we're attacked, where it's really appropriate to defend. But we don't believe that there's a time where you go out and aggress against somebody else. There's not a time when you start a war. That shouldn't exist.
And that includes regime change, CIA.
That's a good one. Good add-on.
Yeah. I mean, we're not just talking about formally declared wars that they don't do anymore, I guess. But, you know, and Rand Paul railed about that last week. But, you know, again, it's important that we take our noses out of the affairs of the sovereignties of other countries.
Yep. So this comes down to a very simple principle that you can look up called the non-aggression principle. It's definitely worth checking out. Another example of this, I'm just going to go real briefly, is North Korea. A lot of people go, you know, we got to go fight North Korea. We got to go kill North Korea. And I'll give you this analogy. Imagine your neighbor goes out and buys a gun. And you go, oh, okay, that's a little creepy. And you know, your neighbor's not particularly the most stable guy in the world. On top of that, your neighbor has openly said that he does not like you. And he hates you. And he would love to see your destruction. All of those things suck. All of those things are bad things, potentially. However, there's a big difference between you going down to your neighbor's house and kicking his door in and killing him versus maybe buying a gun yourself and getting a security system or hiring private security to defend yourself, right? So there's a big difference between aggressing and defending. And we have a Department of Defense that is really good at aggressing against others. And we're not a party that supports that. Boy, are we out of time. Thank you guys for listening.
Absolutely.
We're probably going to touch upon a lot of these in deeper conversations. However, if there's one that you particularly want us to talk about, write us at podcast@lpnevada.org. Go to that website, see how you can get involved. We would love to see your involvement in the future. And until next time, let's make it all about freedom.
This show is brought to you by the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Music is provided by T. Sims. Please support the show by subscribing, sharing it with friends, and leaving a positive review on iTunes. For more information or to learn how to get involved, visit lpnevada.org. Thank you for listening.